You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I have a great topic for you today, and one that we don't talk enough about. It's an entire piece of history that has often been hidden, overlooked, suppressed, but it's the history of sex work in America. My guest is an expert in this area. Caitlin Bailey is a natural-born contrarian and professional provocateur, stand-up comic, writer, sex worker advocate, and the host of the Oldest Profession podcast, which you should definitely go listen to. She's dedicated her life to telling better sex worker stories. Welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Thank you so much for having me, Tristan. It's an honor to be here. I'm really excited.
So I've been listening to the podcast and just generally like stalking you online.
Thank you. I mean, I'm an aggressively public person. I don't think you can call it stalking. I think okay. It's just, yeah.
I've simply Googled you. Okay. That's true.
They're my promotional tweets.
Correct.
Is that asking for it? Is that blaming the victim? I'm not sure. We're fine.
Okay. I wanted to start with your really great YouTube video. You guys should go look this up on YouTube. It's U.S. History from a Whore's Eye View.
This is the presentation I did for the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Foundation. Is that?
No, you did it for someone else. Something okay. Like called Cat. It was like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is the one where I'm drinking whiskey, right?
Yes, you're drinking whiskey. And yes. The person's drinking red wine.
Yes. That's great.
Okay, now we have a marker for that.
I'm sorry.
The thing is, it was a sort of a great introduction because it's like it's a place that I could send someone where they say, well, what's the deal like with sex work history? And it's a good digestible nugget to say, hey, go, there's this presentation. And then within that presentation, you can like then go deeper, research these other things. But to me, it was really comprehensive. And for someone who like doesn't want to read the whole book, because there are some great books
there
out there.
There are so many books.
So I wonder if you will tell me about Mary Jones.
For sure. Yeah, I think the biggest thing for sex workers in history is that we've always been a part of the story, right? It's the oldest profession. So we've been everywhere the whole time. And we've been, our stories are actively erased, both like in our own time and then also revisionist history, sort of going back and when we tend to get erased right out of the narrative even when we left a mark. And Mary Jones is one of these great stories that reminds us of that, because the only reason that we know anything about her life is because of her court records and the newspaper articles that were written at the time, right? You know, she didn't leave a diary. None of her contemporaries, you know, wrote down their history in the way that, wealthier families have their history documented. But Mary Jones was a Black trans sex worker in New York City, working in 1830. So like during slavery, before sex work was criminalized, before the brothels were shut down. And so she's a fascinating case because she's sort of a window into this period of U.S. history before there were police raids on brothels, right? Before there were undercover police officers picking up people who were, plying their trade. And so she was working during the day as a man, as a cleaning person and cook for a totally legally licensed operating brothel in the West Village of Manhattan. And then by night, she would go and pick up her own clients as Mary Jones. And of course, she was also stealing wallets, which is what she ultimately gets caught for. So a few people, what she would do is she would take somebody's wallet, empty it of cash, and then, you know, sort of replacing one man's wallet with the next. And so one person, one client or victim, depending on how you think about it, ends up with somebody else's wallet, goes and looks up that person, and then they team up to motivate the local police officer into going undercover and catching Mary Jones, who was stealing wallets. And so he pulls off this undercover thing, finds all of these empty wallets, arrests her, and it's only at that point that her gender identity is revealed. And so prostitution is not a crime in the 1830s, but buggery, or, you know, homosexual sexual activity definitely is. But none of Mary Jones' clients will admit to having engaged in sodomy. And so the press comes up with this banana pants theory that Mary Jones, as an undercover trans sex worker, was fashioning beefsteak underneath her skirts so as to mimic the female vulva, right? And the press runs with it. And so she gets the misnomer Beefsteak Pete, because her birth name is Peter Swally. And she faces charges for wallet thievery, essentially. And this badass shows up to court in the mid-1830s as Mary Jones in full drag, as she would say. And it faces charges, is sentenced to 8 years, and then comes out. And there are a couple of newspaper mentions of Mary Jones going right back to the brothel, back to her old life, and living until her dying day in her gender identity amongst a community that accepted her, which, of course, were the brothels of New York in the 1830s.
Oh, my God. It's such an incredible story.
Right?
I was just struck by it right away. I was like, first of all, I don't know the story of Mary Jones, right? That's the first realization. And then it's like, holy shit, is she a badass? Because she's right. Challenging not one, not two, not, you know, like multiple conventions all at once.
And this is something that I think is really interesting when you start to look back into, you know, the history of sex workers, which intersects, of course, with like the history of queer culture. And you look back, like the brothels are the birthplace of jazz in America, right? In New Orleans. Brothels were a home to the ballroom culture, supported by, you know, in Harlem, in the Village, in the 1830s, 1860s, 1870s. You know, the sex workers and the spaces that they create have really been an incubator for so much creativity and advocacy and social movements and really big social change. And I think that that's part of the story that I really wish more of our mainstream politicians and folks understood, that not only are sex workers not evil, but we actually have so much good to contribute to society, right? Both in the national narrative is worse off because our voices are suppressed.
Right, right. So one thing that I learned that I didn't know from your video was this connection between sex work, the military, and STDs.
Oh yeah, it's
and the
crazy.
So-called sort of American plan. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. This is one of the. It's a piece in history that, like, every time I start to talk about it, I really have to check my, like, this is the kind of story that I corner people at parties with, right? Like, this is why I'm not fun at dinner parties, because I get so worked up and it makes me so mad, like, every time I start talking about it. But, you know, we're living through a global pandemic at the moment. So just like banana pants choices on a global and national scale that are the opposite of helpful shouldn't take anybody by surprise. But for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, medical schools, both in Europe and also in the US, were teaching that basically that women's bodies are gross, right? That we're vectors of disease, we're slimy, right? We're the cause of the downfall of mankind. We're burdened by Eve, you know, the pains of childbirth, and that like our bodies are just sort of weak versions of men, right? This starts with Aristotle and sort of culminates with the father of gynecology in the 1870s, who is like just recommending hysterectomies left and right to solve all kinds of things, including like wives who were too horny, which was like a big problem apparently in the 1870s. Is like, you got yourself a wife, she's too horny, she's too mouthy. Option one, hysterectomy. Option two, lobotomy. Either way, your problem is solved.
Oh my God.
But I think it's important to understand that backdrop and the medical context of which these ideas are coming out of. So every army in the history of the world has experienced some kind of STD problem, right? For hundreds of years, it was syphilis. You know, we've had a variety of venereal diseases, but like sex workers and soldiers go together like peanut butter and jelly since before that was a sandwich, right? Way back to the Epic of Gilgamesh, sex workers are a civilizing force on soldiers. They provide some really important labor in the camps, ranging of course from sexual services all the way to like laundry and food and other stuff. But there are these sort of like micro economies, camp followers. So that's a tale as old as time, right? But at the dawn of World War I, right, after industrialization, after all of these big innovations and the medicalization of so much, the morality police basically sort of team up with doctors and decide that loose women are like a bigger threat to national security than like communism. Like just the absolute, there's this huge PR campaign, right? She may look clean, but she's not. And so this is where you get the first conflation of sex workers or prostitutes with promiscuity, right? There's no distinction made between a woman who engages in premarital sex and somebody who is, selling sex for a living. Both of these are the same because they're both potential vectors of disease. And so the US military, in all of its infinite wisdom, empowers local law enforcement to round up quote unquote loose women as like part of a national security, like part of the American theater or the American participation of World War I. So this starts in the 1910s and it continues into the 1970s. I think that's the part, like this is the beginnings of the legal framework that eventually becomes the eugenics program that we have in this country. But essentially, local cop, like if you make the wrong eye contact with a cop in 1920 near a military base, he can force you to undergo an STD test. And if a chauvinistic doctor thinks that your privates look too loose, then you could be forced into a lock hospital and injected with mercury and permanently labeled a dangerous woman. And that's like real public policy that I would argue continues today with the raids on hotel rooms and massage parlors and the continued criminalization of prostitution stems from this basic bad idea that it is women's bodies and not men's bodies that are spreading STDs. I mean, even middle-class feminists at the time are like, hey, every time a Navy ship comes to town, the STI rate spikes. So why are we blaming the prostitutes who were here the whole time? Like, why is right, that? Right. Why is that happening? Just as a mom, right? Like watching the way that this port town works. But you know, this is a real part of our history. It informs the contemporary narrative around the policing and criminalization of sex work. The spread of STIs continues to dominate that discussion. Nevada is a really great example of this, but like sex workers as infections is part of this story. And it's never been true, right? And armies have always had the power. If you have the power to send a dude to his death or to murder another human being, you definitely have the power to look at his dick and see if it's okay. But no armies would do that. Like the American military is like, it would be an invasion of our soldiers' privacy to test them for STDs. Instead, we have to round up all of the local sluts and terrorize them for being out alone at night.
God. I mean, and it just, you're right. It continues to this day. I mean, it's such an intense control of women's bodies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And also just the woman's body as sort of a problem.
Right. Right. To be controlled. And,
yes,
you know, they say they're cracking down on sex workers, which, you know, I think that, you know, I would push back, but there are some people that are like, well, that's a crime and you should arrest criminals, I guess. But they're not actually only rounding up sex workers. They're rounding up women that they have labeled sex workers, which is a wholly different category of person, right? Mm-hmm. These are people who are dressed a certain way. These are poor women. These are members of any oppressed minority. Right? Like, you don't think that cops that are cracking down, that like racist police officers that are cracking down on Black communities aren't just using this to terrorize? I mean, like, of course that's a part of that history. Of course police officers are not perfect actors in these situations. Like, the same kind of dude that becomes a police officer today was that same kind of person in 1910, right? Like, these are, it's whatever.
I mean, it's fascinating. And also there's also this economic element, which is that many people are doing sex work to survive, but also mm-hmm. with the implementation of the brothels and women running those brothels, it's like women are independent creatures who can make money.
And it becomes a real threat. Like sex workers have kind of always posed an existential threat to patriarchy, because like, you can't have a patriarchy if you don't know who the dads are. But like, because of the way biology works, it like doesn't matter how many men I have sex with. I'm just going to know it's my baby. Like, that's how biology works. So sex workers who engage in multiple partners kind of shine a light on that foundational problem, right, with patriarchy, which is that it's a dumb way to track lineage, right? So that's sort of a bigger existential point. But specifically, American history, madam owners were often some of the largest landholders. Colorado is the first state to give women suffrage. That is in huge part because sex workers were the highest wage earners and the largest property owners. And it's hard to deprive people with economic power of political power. But when you deprive people of political power, it is easy to strip them of their financial power, which is what happens to madams and sex workers throughout the West. And I think that Atoy in San Francisco is a really great example of this. So Atoy immigrated to San Francisco 7 years before it became a city. She was one of the first Chinese women to live in San Francisco, one of four, actually, according to early census records. And she arrived and immediately began working as a sex worker for herself as an independent business owner. And in fact, because sex work wasn't criminalized, she actually took clients who attempted to defraud her by paying her in fool's gold instead of gold to court. She used the American court system to hold her clients accountable and to stem off the local tongs or the Chinese gangs who were attempting to bring her under their control. So she actually used the court system to advocate for herself as a business owner, as an immigrant woman in, I think, like the 1880s in San Francisco. But she lives through the criminalization of prostitution, which happens in the early 1900s as a direct result of some openly racist vigilante and moral campaigns. Actually called the San Francisco Vigilante Committee, but that's a whole, I digress. And so as sex work becomes criminalized and as she's no longer able to defend herself in court, she starts to become arrested and she was a millionaire and she's essentially run out of town. And I think that that is something that happens to like truly powerful women in early American cities become stripped of their power through slut shaming. Right? It's like these are the original nasty women who, you know, rise to the heights of their industry. And that you see this a lot in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, 1910s. One of the first Black millionaires in this country after slavery was a sex worker. But, you know, it's when you criminalize something, it becomes easy to seize your property.
Mm-hmm. And so we're at the turn of the century, and at this point, people, it's not illegal. It's not on the books as illegal, right? Sex work. It's not on the books. You can fuck with someone in other ways, right?
Yeah. Of course. There's, right? Yeah, there's
like vagrancy charges and other weird.
Yeah. It's like, yes, prostitution isn't illegal, but also married women have no rights. So it's like a real mixed bag of legality. You know what I mean? Like when you like disappear as a person and he's like allowed to beat you with something that's like not bigger than his thumb, it's like hard to talk about, you know, like true agency in that kind of culture.
Right.
But yes, sex workers are the highest wage earners in their environment often, right? Like sex workers in frontier towns are often making twice what local male laborers are making. And they're certainly making more than domestic workers.
Wow.
Okay, and then of course, that's to say nothing of madam owners, of course, who are able to accumulate property and do the thing that capitalists do, you know?
We're going to take our first break because we do need to engage in some capitalism, which is to give space to our advertisers who pay for the show.
Sure. Sorry.
Make it happen. Okay. So let's do that. Let's engage in a little capitalism. And we'll be right back with Caitlin Bailey. This year, turn your resolutions into reality with Sakara. Hey, I'm going to be honest. I've been eating like crap during the pandemic. Like me, if you're looking to change your diet, instead of restricting what you eat, what if you nourished your body with the healthiest and most nutritious food? With Sakara, you're putting the best in your body so you can feel your best. Sakara is a nutrition company that focuses on overall wellness, starting with what you eat. Their organic, ready-to-eat meals are made with powerful plant-based ingredients, and they're designed to boost your energy, improve your digestion, and get your skin glowing. The menu of creative, chef-crafted breakfasts, lunches, and dinners changes weekly, so you'll never get bored. And it's delivered fresh anywhere in the United States. I absolutely love the meals. One of my favorites is the Prosperity Pad Thai. It's not your typical pad thai, but it's super fresh with kelp noodles, an Asian lettuce mix, all kinds of good veggies, especially these sweet, crisp sugar snap peas, which really make it for me. Yum. Oh, and the dressing? I would buy it by the bottle. Here's the thing, it did improve my digestion. That isn't just hype. Along with delicious, plant-rich meals, Sakara also offers daily wellness essentials like supplements and herbal teas to support your nutrition. Experience the power of plants as medicine with their best-selling Metabolism Super Powder. Made with organic, raw cacao, it works to boost energy, eliminate bloating, minimize sugar cravings, and reduce fatigue. And right now, Sakara is offering our listeners 20% off their first order when they go to sakara.com/Tristan. Or you can enter code Tristan at checkout. That's Sakara, sakara.com/Tristan to get 20% off your first order. This is a great thing to try out, and I know you're going to love it. Sakara.com/Tristan. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We've been talking about sex worker history with Caitlin Bailey, who's the host of the Oldest Profession podcast, which you should definitely check out. So we got a good primer on what's happened. And I feel like I just wanted to then introduce this idea about how it becomes criminalized, how the laws are written, and how those laws at the turn of the century are still in play today.
Yeah, and I'm glad that we sort of left off before the break with the story of Atoy, because I feel like her life is sort of a demonstration of what the meta story on this is. Right. So in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, the antebellum period, you have Black communities that are exercising political power. You have immigrant communities, like the expansion of the ballot. You know, it's a heady time in American democracy, right? This is the period of time that Victoria Woodhull is running for president with Frederick Douglass on the ballot. She's another old pro that we cover on the podcast. It's kind of a revolutionary period. I like to be like, the 1870s were a little bit like the 1970s, and that there were just like all kinds of people that were coming out of the woodwork to organize. Labor unions are a big part of this. And so, you know, rich white dudes are real nervous on multiple fronts, right? The abolition of slavery on the one hand and the organizing of labor on the other, right? Like rich dudes, both members of the Confederacy and the Union, have reason to worry that their actual workers and the folks are going to start cutting into their profits. So I didn't mean for this to sound so communist. This is not a people's history.
I'm here for the socialism.
All right, cool. Right. Yeah.
I actually, but yeah.
So
doesn't offend me. Let's bring on the fucking socialism.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
let's read. Yeah.
Sex workers are sort of a part of this stew. As I said before, you know, madam owners become some of the largest landowners in the West. Places like Storyville and Charleston are places like where Black women are accumulating wealth. Same thing in like Chicago and New York, you have a lot of powerful women who are accumulating wealth at the same time that women are agitating for their own suffrage. This is a sort of long-winded way of saying there was a lot going on, but there was also a backlash, and that is the moral movement, the vigilante movement, the KKK is a part of this. And what they essentially do is they equate immorality and vice with immigrants, poor communities, communities of color. Jim Crow is a direct result of this. You see a lot of vigilante communities in both like San Francisco and New York. You know, you see Anthony Comstock, who of course wrote the Comstock laws. There's a lot of equating with like sexy stuff with degeneracy and like infections of the body, as we said before. So labor organizing becomes an infection and prostitution becomes a symbol of this infection. And it's really interesting, two things happen simultaneously. The first is the myth of the white slave law, which really comes into effect in the 1910s. But this is sort of revisionist history after the Civil War, where folks say the problem was not enslaving Black people in this country. The problem is the animalistic lusts of Black men, and we must do everything in our power to protect white women from this encroaching threat, right? And this is, I think, best captured in the film Birth of a Nation, which it's impossible to overstate the cultural impact of that film. It's the first film screened at the White House. It's a cultural phenomenon. And essentially, if you haven't seen it, and why would you? It's a real racist film from like 1910. The KKK are the good guys in this movie. And it frames this Black man attempting to rape a white woman in the film as like the natural result of emancipation. And so we criminalize in this country alcohol, abortion, and prostitution, all at the same time and all for the same reasons. And it's this mix of racism and moralization and the idea that we can arrest our way out of social problems. And you see this massive crackdown on vice, right? So we criminalize alcohol, we shut down the brothels, we erect this white slavery narrative and call ourselves the good guys. We're not arresting bootleggers, we're saving the children from degeneracy. We also crack down, interestingly enough, on pinball machines. That's also a big part of this. And in many places, dancing. This is the criminalization of gay clubs as well. Mm-hmm. So all of that sort of starts to happen. And like many laws in this country, it happens at first on a local level and then kind of snowballs into national policy. So the first federal anti-prostitution law in this country was the Page Act of 1873. And it's also our first anti-immigration law. This later becomes the Chinese exclusion law, but it essentially states that Chinese women are not allowed to immigrate to the United States for immoral purposes. The second federal anti-prostitution law is called the White Slave Law of 1910, also known as the Mann Act. And that criminalizes transporting women across state lines for, again, with the same language, immoral purposes. Now, this is sold to the American public as essentially an anti-trafficking law, an anti-white slave law, hence the name. But its actual enforcement is for Jim Crow. We start prosecuting interracial relationships because any white woman engaged in a sexual relationship with a Black man cannot consent to that and is, by definition, engaging in immoral behavior.
And, oh God, I mean, it's so insane because then there's all these parallels today with these trafficking laws.
Yeah, technology changes, but people don't.
But like the basic moralizing is like still there. And also the imagination, of crimes that are not being committed.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And so we're doing the same thing today that we were doing in the 1910s, which was we are erecting a fake moral problem, right? White slavery, human trafficking, right? Really exaggerating and sort of mythologizing how that happens, and then using that story to mobilize the, you know, criminalization and incarceration of massive groups of people, right? So like in 1910, the movie version of this is Birth of a Nation. Today, it's, you know, Liam Neeson's Taken, right? Both of those are lies about how people get into sex work or what sex work looks like or how it should be policed. And in both of those cases, the proposed solution is righteous violence, right? It's like we can arrest the bad guys, we can kill the bad guys, we can hunt the bad guys, and then that will save our proverbial and literal innocence, right? Prostitution becomes like a symbol, right, that we project all of our bigger anxieties onto.
Right, right. And then it also becomes a red herring.
Right.
That we can now ignore these other things and put it on prostitution.
Yeah, we can ignore actual trafficking, you know, like forced farm labor, right? That's like a major issue. Like there are people in this country who are currently chained to beds, right? Like who are picking our fruits and vegetables.
Who are not sex slaves, by the way.
Right, yes, who are not exactly. Sex slaves, right? But like that's real trafficking. But instead we keep looking for white girls chained to radiators. And it's like, no, that's your sexual fantasy. The real problem here is exploitation, which is bigger than the sex trade.
Right. Which is exploitation,
but we can't
of all
see
labor.
It. Right.
Yes.
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 So I listened to a bunch of your podcasts, which I love because you have this like crazy diverse lineup of folks that you profile from, you know, Toulouse-Lautrec to Victoria Woodhull, who you mentioned. Cardi B is in there, which is great. And I liked
we just did Melania Trump, which was fun.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's another one where I got tipsy. That was a special election night. So me and my historian, we got drunk together on election night and just talk shit about Melania Trump. And there's like some history in there, but it's also a lot of just, you know, whiskey talk.
Right. But I like this idea that you also liken the 1870s to the 1970s in that like a lot of shit started happening. So I want to kind of fast forward because the 1970s does become really critical in sex work history. And one of the people that you profile on your podcast is Valerie Solanas.
Yes.
Let's talk about Valerie.
Yeah. Valerie Solanas is, you know, I think that she is a creative genius, but because she was in the body of a contrarian woman, she ends up not being recognized. As you like, she did try to shoot Andy Warhol, and I see how like that would be like a bridge too far for anyone, right? But but you know, so Valerie Solanas was a sex worker and playwright in the 1970s who, like many creative people, sexual deviants, was rejected by her mother, and so she is homeless for a period of time. But she's one of these sort of like uncompromising contrarian figure. She reminds me a lot of Sylvia Rivera in that energy where she is holding on to righteousness, right? And she's like, it's wrong for me to live in a society that slut shames me and celebrates my rapist, right? It's wrong for me to have to participate in sex work in order to have my survival needs met but I'm shamed for that, which makes it less likely that people meet my survival needs. She says it more eloquently than that because she's a better writer than I am. But she writes these really provocative pieces that are really steeped in this like kind of in your face feminism. Andy Warhol, according to Valerie Solanas, offers to produce her work, but something happens between them and he ends up either ignoring her or ghosting her or something. And so she shows up to Andy's studio and shoots him. And I think like gets him in the shoulder or the arm or something. And she is sent to a psychiatric ward. And then one of the great tragedies of her life, you know, like, which I think often gets overshadowed by her attempted murder, which I get why people focus on that, but like, it's just, you know, it's like 1 second in her life, is when her biographers and she gets, you know, she becomes famous. Her mother is caught burning all of her writing. And so we only have just a few pieces of hers that have survived, some plays and essays, and I guess what we would call zines that are still around. Yeah.
I mean, I do think she's sort of one of the unsung feminists. In some ways, we don't pay enough attention to her because, like you said, there was this 1 second where she, you know, lost her mind.
Yeah, she's kind of like if Andrea Dworkin never achieved academic recognition, right? That's like kind of
right
where she, yeah.
One of the great thinkers, right?
Yes.
But that never, and also that her work was lost. I mean, we don't,
yes.
It's like, that's, it's just sort of tragic.
Yeah. And she, you know, I think like so many, you know, luminaries in this field, it's like, I agree with almost everything she says, although I disagree with her tactics and rhetorical. I understand why her rhetorical choices were like not palpable to the mainstream, right? Like this is like, she was never going to be invited to the DNC. I get it.
Right. And so you have this variety of characters that you profile on the show. One of them is Cardi B.
I love her.
What I love about Cardi B is just that, like, she will not denounce her previous sex work, and mm-hmm. she will not say, "I'm reformed now," or "I'm in a legit industry of music," which is also questionable.
Well, that's legit. Well, I mean, well, first of all, somebody speaking as somebody who has worked as both a sex worker and also in entertainment, it's not better. You don't like, you know what I mean? Like,
People ask me all the time, like, you know, like, did you feel exploited? Blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what? I have worked under conditions where I felt tremendously exploited and compromised. And that was when I worked in television.
I swear to God. You know what? Nobody ever tried to pay me an exposure in sex work, right? Like, oh my God, they understood that it was a blowjob and I was going to get compensated. Yeah. Nobody was like, oh, I'll write you a review. And then, absolutely not.
The coercion of television producers is like, it's really unmined. I mean, they are soulless. I have met many soulless television producers.
Soulless television producers. And now I do quite a bit of political fundraising, which is another soulless, vast, you know, standing on the abyss of humanity, right? And it's like, and that is something where you can compromise yourself and then still end up not getting paid, right? Which is something, again, that would never have happened in sex work.
Right. So give people a taste of what Cardi B's sex work past was like.
Yeah, so Cardi B started her professional career as a cashier at a grocery store chain, but then sort of quickly does, you know, what many sex workers have done, which is the math, and realizes that she would be better off working as a stripper, and then sort of creates the persona that we see today in that environment, right? Where she goes and she gets a lot of plastic surgery, and she creates the character of Cardi B first in the strip club, which I think is an important place for, like, you know, like we're informed by our environment, you know, like I'm not sure if Cardi B's creative potential could have been unlocked if she tried to sweat it out, you know, as a cashier. right? Like, I feel like she'd probably, you know, her manager would probably tell her that she wasn't allowed to wear those earrings at $9 an hour or whatever. Mm-hmm. So Cardi B becomes a stripper and engages in, you know, what some people, I don't like the phrase survival sex work, but like engages in some sporadic sex work outside the bounds of like just looking but not touching, as mm-hmm. one would say. One of the stories that she tells that I think is an interesting hustler story and sort of brings out a really interesting dynamic and got, there was like a news cycle about it, when Cardi B admits to drugging one of her clients in order to do what Mary Jones did, right? Which is steal their money to live another day. So that I think is one of my favorite like conservative Republican uncle arguments for decriminalizing sex work, right? This is where I really am able to back my corner in a family, because you can get your racist uncle to be like, Cardi B is a criminal and she should be arrested, right? And it's like, well, if we decriminalize sex work, then her victims would be able to report her. But as it is, they're just both participating in prostitution. So,
right.
Yeah. So anyway, that's like an argument that I don't agree on. I think that people do what they need to survive. And I think that criminalizing survival is the problem. If you want fewer people stealing wallets, then create a better social safety net. But people are going to get their needs met. You can't just ask people to die for politeness.
Right.
So, yeah.
And I think she's also brought in these sort of markers of sex work, you know, again, like your theme of the nasty woman.
Yes.
Whenever she puts out a song, a video, a mini movie, people freak the fuck out.
It's delicious. It's great. Yeah. She's absolutely a provocateur, which I love. And she's also, you know, somebody who is bringing a sex worker ethos into the mainstream, which I think is really important, right? She's unapologetically interested in getting paid, right? Like one of my favorite lines from her work is like, I like morning sex, but what I really want are checks, right? And yes. and I think that is, and again, she says it better, but you know, there's something to that where like as a woman in comedy, as a woman in politics, like my ambition is a real liability in social situations in a way that it wasn't and isn't as a sex worker. And so Cardi B as a working artist, bringing her sex worker ethos to like, all right, yeah, but first give me my money, I think is excellent. And I think that more female entrepreneurs and women in business could deal with a massive, like destigmatizing female ambition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, just the notion that women do a lot of different things in this world and don't get paid. We do a lot of jobs and a lot of labor that simply isn't acknowledged and is certainly not acknowledged with money.
And I think that that's one of the big existential threats of sex work, right? And it's one of the things that I think a real missed moment in the history of feminism, right, is where we had an opportunity to embrace sex workers in the 1870s, actually, with Victoria Woodhull's campaign. And turned away from that, right? The Elizabeth Cady Stantons and Susan B. Anthony's of the world chose to exile Victoria for respectability of politics, to distance themselves from quote unquote loose women. Mm-hmm. And I think that contemporary feminists have an opportunity with 100 years, you know, behind us to embrace sex workers, to embrace women that violate sexual mores. Because I think that if we live in a world that embraces sex workers, we are living in a world where we are all more free.
Mm. Okay, on that note, we're going to take a break for capitalism, okay, under which we are not all free. And this show is not free.
Good, that's great. No, get that money.
Yeah,
Tracy, so get it.
So, yes, so cash that check. And then give it right over to Zencaster and also my editor, an engineer. Okay.
So, see, you're a job creator.
I'm a job creator. That's what I'm doing. Okay. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about this moment. You brought up fundraising. And so you do double duty also as an activist, an advocate. And I want to talk about the work you're doing right now. So stay with us, more with Caitlin Bailey when we return. One of the most powerful ways to improve your overall health and happiness is to get a good night's sleep. But if your daily routine has changed, it can be harder to fall and stay asleep. That's why I'm excited to partner once again this year with Calm, the app designed to help you ease stress and get the best sleep of your life. When I get a good night's sleep and I stick to a regular sleep schedule, it improves everything. My energy level, concentration, resilience, and my overall mood. Calm has a whole library of programs designed for healthy sleep, like soundscapes, guided meditations, and over 100 sleep stories, narrated by wonderful voices like Stephen Fry, Kelly Rowland, and Laura Dern. They also just added music, nice ambient music by Moby. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library with new content added every week. Get started today at calm.com/Tristan. That's calm.com/TRISTAN. Get the Calm app and experience a transformation in the way you sleep. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I've been talking today with the host of the Oldest Profession podcast, Caitlin Bailey. And Caitlin, you mentioned in the last segment about how you do political fundraising. And so I want to talk about some of your current work, because you joined Decriminalize Sex Work, which is an important organization that's really on the front lines of doing sex worker rights right now. So tell me about what you do for them.
Decriminalize Sex Work is a great organization, and I'm really, really proud of the work that I did with them. But my last day as their communications director was actually October 30th, so just a month ago today. And they have a fantastic new comms director. And what Decriminalize Sex Work as an organization is pursuing a state-by-state strategy to try to end the prohibition of prostitution in the U.S. And so they have active campaigns in Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, really all across the country. There are cool things happening. But I started Old Pro Productions with the Oldest Profession podcast to tell better sex worker stories. And we have our first big event coming up January 25th, which is the anniversary of the first sex worker-led protest in this country, which, you know, longtime listeners of the podcast will know happened in San Francisco in 1917, right on the cusp of the sort of imminent closure of their brothels, which happened just a few weeks later. So 300 sex workers marched asking the moralizers and the politicians of San Francisco, where do you expect us to go? Which I think is a fair and reasonable question 103 years later. So we are funding an art build in five cities across the country, in New York and New Orleans, San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington, where local activists are teaming up with artists to create works that celebrate the old pros in their local city, because we really did build this country, and it's time that we reclaimed our place in history.
And a public place.
Yes.
A very public place. Right. Mm-hmm. Which I think, again, is really important, because so much of this kind of went on behind closed doors.
Yes.
And therefore is not part of history. Okay. So tell me about this fundraiser on January 25th.
It's called the Old Pro Project. And we were trying to raise an additional $40,000 to get us set up for next year and cover our overhead costs and get money into the hands of sex worker activists and sex worker artists who are hustling and working on creating these public art projects all over the country that are going to become a part of this big virtual campaign January 25th. It's a really exciting project. So,
and so yeah, how
please
can
check
people,
it out on our website.
Yeah. It's going to be on your website. So it's on Oldest Profession.
Yeah. Go to the oldestprofessionpodcast.com and it's called The Old Pro Project. You can't miss it. It's on our landing page. We've already raised $54,000. So we are just trying to ask our community and fans of the show, fans of sex worker art, to get us over the home stretch so that we can get everyone paid.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, sex work now more than ever, especially since Sesta Fosta, there's been a real coming together and a lot more activism and public dialogue around sex work. I mean, do you imagine that sex work will be decriminalized in your lifetime?
I mean, that is definitely a fantasy and a vision and a dream that I have that keeps me moving forward, right? I would love nothing more than to just go back to being a stand-up comic that makes fun of my husband, right? Like that would be, that'd be great, but like a regular person. But I feel called to this work. I feel called to stand up for women and for sex workers and for marginalized and for criminalized people and to say the increasingly obvious thing, which this is wrong, right? This is a wrong and dumb way to solve these problems, right? And I think that the decriminalization of prostitution is really a philosophical key that opens many, many doors, right? Maybe, you know, this might be someone's first step in realizing that we can't arrest our way out of every imaginable problem, or that a better solution to folks that are homeless is to provide housing, right? Instead of criminalizing loitering. You know, there are a lot of questions, right, that the way that we have treated the oldest profession raises that I think leads to a more just, a more equitable, and a more livable society.
Well, and I think there also has to be a critical mass here that begins to understand that the criminalization of sex work harms all of us.
Everyone.
Right. Yes. This is like if white people think they're doing anti-racist work for people of color,
right?
That's not actually what's going on. White supremacy actually harms everyone.
All of us. Yes.
We all have a horse in the race. We all have a stake in the game.
Right.
And so I wonder if you'll make that argument that how is, like, why should everyone, not just sex workers, ex-sex workers, friends and loved ones of sex workers, but why does everyone need to be invested in this movement?
Well, I think first and foremost, everyone knows a sex worker, right? That sex workers are like gay people in the 1950s and 60s. And that, like, we are everywhere is something that I would say. So that if you think that you don't know anybody that engages in this work, you're wrong. But on a bigger philosophical level, whore phobia is the tip end of the spear of misogyny. And misogyny and patriarchy and all of the laws that infantilize and criminalize and limit the potential, the freedom of expression and freedom of movement for women, for queer people, for gender nonconforming people, are a part of the shackles that keep all of us married to these gender roles that serve no one. You know, you're talking about how racism hurts white people. Misogyny hurts men. And I think that if you understand why releasing ourselves from the false binary of gender roles and the subjugation of women and nonconforming folks, then you understand why the criminalization of sex work is often both the justification and the pointy end of the spear. And I think when you cut it off, it's, you know, dull spears are easier to fight. You know, like it's I feel like without whorephobia, misogyny looks dumb, you know, it's easier to laugh at.
Right. Right. And every woman is subject to whorephobia. There are women and non-binary people who are marginalized and have multiple marginalizations who experience it on the regular.
Yes.
And there are some women who are protected from it because of their class or their race, but we all experience whorephobia, and other women police police women, right?
I've never met a domestic violence victim that wasn't called a whore, whether they engaged in sex work or not. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is something we saw it so clearly with the Me Too movement, right? That somebody who is standing up to report sexual assault, the first thing that you don't do is call them a whore, right? The first thing that you do is accuse them of wanting money, wanting attention, being willing to use sex to get that, right? When Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman at the second presidential debate, he was calling her a whore. And I think that we need to recognize that, and we can, and we should, and we will defang that insult by making it matter less, because it never should have mattered to begin with. Mm. The fact that we were all willing to collectively accept the incredibly dumb idea that women are, or people are, devalued by the sex that they engage in or is done to them is ridiculous to me.
That's a great way to end. Caitlin knows her shit, basically. Thank you so much for being on the show. Let me tell people how they can find you. The podcast, which you can find on podcast platforms, is The Oldest Profession. The website is theoldestprofessionpodcast.com. On Instagram and Twitter, you can find Caitlin at Caitlin Bailey. Her first name is spelled KaytlinBailey. And also, you can find the show at Old Pro Podcast. Thanks so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to shout out my engineer and editor, A-Rod, at FTC Designs. You can follow him and hire him and pay him at FTC_designs. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Monday. I am across social media platforms at Tristan Taramino. And take some time to talk about sex work and whore phobia out loud.